Hey, welcome back to That 70s Card Show. I am your host, John Keating, and I thank you for joining me as I take a look back at the cards and the culture of the very colorful 1970s. We'll revisit a more simple time in our hobby by taking a deep dive into the sets and the stats with a generous amount of dad facts sprinkled in. That 70s Card Show is currently sponsored by Nobody. If you have a comment or suggestion, I urge you to drop me a line at that70scardshow@gmail.com, that70scardshow on YouTube, or 70scard on Twitter. So this is episode 31. Yes, we made it to 31. I know I keep saying that, but it's pretty awesome. I'll talk a little bit about the my week here collecting. Philly Card Show was this past weekend, and Friday, monumental day in my collecting. After 50 plus years, I finally finished the 1971 Topps set. Last three cards, Buckner rookie card, which really wasn't that big of a deal. Surprised it's cheap, as cheap as it is for that set and high numbers. Bobby Mercer and Jim Qualls, all high numbers. Again, finished those off Friday. That was my goal and my mission Friday, was to knock out the 71 set, put everything in there in the binder, all stowed away. I noticed I had an empty spot. Of course, it's one of the few, it's the only 71 slab I have, which was the Yaz. So I took a deep breath and exhaled, and everything was okay. Full complete set, 1971 Topps baseball done. Went back Sunday like a fool and tried to get myself some more 70 Topps baseball and 72 Topps baseball. 72, I have 43 cards left. 1970, I have 122 cards left. 70 is more complicated, a lot more big hitters, heavy hitters in that one than in the 72. I think the 72, of course, in great timing. Today I went this morning, and by the time I got off the airplane, I'm in Las Vegas right now. By the time I got off of the airplane, Jim Cott had been elected to the Hall of Fame. And I happen to need the Jim Cott and the Jim Cott in action card from 1972 Topps. So good job, John. You could have done that Friday or this morning, but no. Also landed me some Kellogg's 3D sets, 74 and 79 in completion. I have some of the I had the Yaz one from 79. I had the Nolan Ryan from 74. And I think the Yaz from 74, so just a big old stack of 3D baseball cards right out of the cereal box 40-plus years ago. The Philly show warms my heart because it's where I grew up, but more so it's because of the large amount of vintage and ephemera there. A lot of oddball stuff, which is really cool. A lot of autographs going on. Saw a lot of player-specific layouts at tables, you know, like a table or two, just Clemente. I saw one of Yaz. I had to step away because my mission was to complete 70 through 72. So kind of had to step back a little bit, but that Yaz table looked nice. And it's good to see that. I know we see a lot of shiny things, and I think the current state of the hobby is awesome with everybody involved in all sectors. But obviously I'm a vintage guy. Again, I don't bemoan the ways of the modern collector, but it's great seeing people sitting at tables, going through binders, completing sets. Seemed busy both days I attended, and I just want to thank the dealers and the promoters that make it such a wonderful event. There's a guy that helped me complete the 71 set over the past two Philly card shows in September and over the summer, I think in June. A guy named John, I think his last name's Hun, and his wife is always there, and his son has been there too. But like I said, I bought a lot of my 71 stuff there, previous two shows from John and his wife. John apparently passed away. I don't know what the circumstances were, but there was a nice memorial set up at his table where he normally is. Sad, of course, because I know he's got a wife and a son who I think is at Columbia University in New York. So my thoughts are with his wife and son. Shame, and always nice to me, both of them. So I wish everybody peace in that family. Again, Hall of Fame weekend, right? Congrats to the newest members of the Baseball Hall of Fame. Hopefully soon to be obsolete. BBWAA has a long way to go to untangle the lines they've cast out. But this is a start. Sure, I think Dick Allen is deserving, but a lot of players are as well. The Veterans Committee was just as guilty. And I'm talking you, the Gas House Gang. We seem to be back on course now. It won't be perfect, and it'll always be debatable, but here's to the future of the Hall of Fame dealio. Again, I got on a plane today, big old 787 out of Philly to Las Vegas for a couple of days of work out here. Hit it back midweek. It's probably close to 4 a.m. Eastern, 12:43 Pacific Coast time, but let's get a podcast done, right? That's my theory when the mood hits. So usually I can print out my notes. I don't have access to a printer, so we're just going to kind of wing this, see what happens there. I have a few comments from previous shows I just want to go over, if that is okay with everybody. Let me get rid of some stuff on the screen here if you're watching on YouTube. So episode 29, we talked about the 75 or 76 SSPC baseball set. Had a couple comments on YouTube. I appreciated Chris at All Time Sports Cards. Dropped me a comment at YouTube. Appreciated the overview. He called it a mysterious set, which is pretty cool. He's been trying to research it as well. He really appreciates the photography. The bench, obviously the bench is probably one of the best pictures in that set. He liked the Brock, the Winfield, Frank Robinson, and many others. Definitely unique compared to Topps. He just picked up a few great examples recently of Aaron, Munson, and Ryan. And as he says, the cards are surprisingly affordable still. Good points, Chris. Haven't seen any of the graded, but I haven't been looking. But it'd be pretty cool to see that old Hank Aaron in that Milwaukee Brewers uniform graded, huh? Or that Johnny Bench in the batting cage. Mark Delaney was kind enough to drop a line on YouTube as well. He said, interesting story about SSPC. He didn't know they existed. He said it was too rich for him in 75 or 76 at 10 bucks. For him, that was a lot of money, like it was for most of us back then, especially as kids. And I wouldn't have even known where to got it to get that set, Mark, to tell you the truth. He said $10 would have been the price of a really nice box set near home plate, which is true, right? I mean, you know, nowadays box seat will cost you $300. Paid $99 a pop at the White Sox to sit past the dugout a couple rows up this past summer. Anyway, he dropped the link into my comments about the Fleer and Donruss right to compete with Topps, the legalese, which is pretty cool. I'm going to read it because it's many, many pages, which is pretty cool. And he sums it up by saying, apparently the Topps versus SSPC lawsuit was settled with an agreement not to disclose. Aaron Stein was sued by Topps and barred from selling them further. He eventually settled with Topps, and part of the settlement was that he couldn't comment on any of the details of the final agreement. Part of the agreement was that Aaron Stein was allowed to dispose of the inventory on hand, and that inventory was substantial enough that a good number of sets made their way onto the market. He was barred from additional printing and advertising because Aaron Stein agreed never to reprint the set. Some collectors feel it has an air of legitimacy. Definitely legitimate set. Real baseball players on there, real uniforms, and Shea Stadium, obviously. So, Mark, thanks for dropping that into the comments on YouTube. I appreciate it. And, again, read that lawsuit if you can. It's pretty cool stuff. Pretty fascinating, you know. I tried to find that. I couldn't find that stuff. So thanks for digging that up, Mark. Appreciate it. A little episode 30 comments on our 74 Topps football. Our boy Ken over at Beansball Card Blog on YouTube, and again, he hosts a fine vintage football thread, sales thread on Friday nights on the Twit. He says, longtime listener, first time caller. First off, this guy's a huge supporter of mine, and I really appreciate it. He's been so kind to me. Anyway, he wants to make a request. I'd love to hear your breakdown of the 72 Topps football set. I am going to work on that for you, Ken. I'm going to get me some of those 72 football cards. I probably should have gotten some this weekend, but I had a lot on my mind. 35th anniversary Saturday, so that's a big chunk of my weekend I devoted to my wife and had a good time. Anyway, I'll work on that for you, Ken, I promise. And Ty Webb said, yes, Danny White punted. So I had questioned myself whether Danny White was a punter while backing up Roger Staubach, and sure enough, Ty Webb has confirmed that. Ty Webb, I think, if I'm not mistaken, Ty Webb has a Mark Ratner profile picture from The Fast Times at Ridgemont High, the greatest movie of the 80s, I think. So thank you, gents, for your comments. Appreciate it. Keep them coming. So anyway, let's move on here. One of my favorite Yinzers once asked me, and if you don't know what a Yinzer is, go look it up. He once asked me what I was going to do when I ran out of sets to talk about from the 1970s. Well, thankfully, there are enough colorful teams, players, stadiums, and sets to keep going for a little while longer. So, as with the 76 SSPC set previously highlighted, the 79 Kellogg's is a fine example of what's still left to dig through. So, without further ragu, and I say that in honor of Eddie Mecca, the big ragu from Laverne and Shirley, who passed away this week, here's a look at this milk-stained classic, the 79 Kellogg's 3D Superstar Baseball Set. So, guess what? This is my third set from 1979. Have not done dad facts yet. So, baseball, obviously, we talked about baseball dad facts. I think I reviewed the 1979 Topps baseball set. So, we're going to do a little go global here. Planes were still falling out of the sky and running into mountains. Africa was a mess. Coup d'etats and overthrows and mercenaries and all that stuff. Northern Ireland was its usual mess, and it was a pretty significant year in the hostilities in Northern Ireland, but we're not going to get into that for other reasons. But we will talk about 1979 and pretty crazy year, and we're going to take a little trip through here, folks. So I'm reading from the Wikipedias. I will later on, when I get to the set, I will quote a lot of Beckett stuff. So Beckett, of course, does not help me with dad facts on a global level. So this is Wikipedia. 79 was a common year starting on Monday of the Gregorian calendar, the 1979th year of the Common Era, CE, and Anno Domini, AD designations, the 979th year of the second millennium, the 79th year of the 20th century, and the 10th and last year of the 70s decade. That's pretty cool math right there. So January 1st, United Nations Secretary Kurt Waldheim heralds the start of the year of the child. We'll get to that in a few. The United States and the People's Republic of China established full diplomatic relations. January 7th, the Cambodian-Vietnamese War, the People's Army of Vietnam, and the Vietnamese-backed Cambodian insurgents announced the fall of Phnom Penh, Cambodia, and the collapse of the Pol Pot regime. Pol Pot and the Khmer Rouge retreat west to an area along the Thai border, ending large-scale fighting. I've been to Cambodia, and they are some of the nicest people I've ever met, especially considering what they've been through. So, yeah, peace in Cambodia, a good thing. January 9th, the Music for UNICEF concert is held at the United Nations General Assembly to raise money for UNICEF to promote the Year of the Child. It is broadcast the following day in the United States and around the world, and guess who hosted it? Yep. The Bee Gees, along with Donna Summer, ABBA, Rod Stewart, and Earth, Wind, and Fire all performed, and the soundtrack album was later released. Boy, if you couldn't tap your beat to that, I guess your foot was broken. January 16th of 1979, Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi flees Iran with his family, relocating to Egypt after a year of turmoil. We know what happened in Iran after that. It wasn't pretty, but it definitely went down starting on January 16th with the Shah fleeing Iran. January 21st, the Pittsburgh Steelers staked their claim as the NFL team of the 1970s by beating the Dallas Cowboys 35-31 at Miami's Orange Bowl in Super Bowl 13. January 29th, Cleveland, this is a sad one, obviously, especially a lot of the stuff is still topical today. So I'm going to point that out as we go through the year here. Cleveland Elementary School shooting in San Diego. Brenda Ann Spencer opens fire at a school in San Diego, killing two faculty members and wounding eight students and a police officer. Her justification for the action, "I don't like Mondays," inspires the Boomtown Rats to make a song of the same name. I think a lot of us remember that song, "I Don't Like Mondays." There's your inspiration. February 1st, Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini returns to Tehran, Iran, after nearly 15 years of exile. Also on February 1st, coincidence or not, I'm not sure, but former Sex Pistols bassist Sid Vicious is released on bail after undergoing a 55-day forceful detoxification program at Rikers Island Prison. He suffers a heroin overdose and dies around midnight. So Sid couldn't bear to see the Ayatollah in Iran. So that was that. February 7th, guess what? Pluto, it is a planet. I don't care what you guys say. Pluto moves inside Neptune's orbit for the first time since either was known to science. February 7th, Nazi criminal Joseph Mengele suffers a stroke and drowns while swimming in Bertioga, Brazil. His remains are found in 1985. That's interesting. It took so long to find his remains. February 13th, the Guardian Angels are formed in New York City as an unarmed organization of young crime fighters. Yes, we needed to be rescued by people in berets and satin jackets, and perhaps we could use a little bit of that right now, because from what I gather, New York's a bit of a mess. But maybe we need those gals and guys back out on their roller skates and satin jackets. February 18th, the Sahara Desert experiences snow for 30 minutes, which is pretty cool. Also on February 18th, the 1979 Daytona 500 is televised on CBS, the first ever full airing of a 500-mile race on U.S. television. Richard Petty wins after Cale Yarborough and Donnie Allison battle for first place on the final lap, and crash out, leading to a fist fight. So this race brought NASCAR to a wider audience. March 5th, the Voyager 1 makes its closest approach to Jupiter at 277,000 kilometers, which is, for Americans, 172,000 miles. March 8th, Philips demonstrates the compact disc publicly for the first time. March 19th, C-SPAN, an American television channel focusing on government and public affairs, is launched. And on March 22nd, the NHL votes to approve its merger with the WHA, effective in the fall. So, hey, that's 79-80 Gretzky rookie, huh? Not bad. March 25th, the first fully functional space shuttle orbiter, Columbia, is delivered to the Kennedy Space Center to be prepared for its first launch. March 26th, in a ceremony at the White House, President Anwar Sadat of Egypt and Prime Minister Menachem Begin of Israel sign an Egypt-Israeli peace treaty. Boy, we could use that now too, right? Another topical thing this day and age. Also on March 26th, Michigan State University, led by Irvin Magic Johnson, defeats Larry Bird and the Indiana State Sycamores 75-64 in the NCAA tournament championship game at Salt Lake City. Both would turn pro, obviously, later that year. Magic earlier than expected, Bird later than expected. March 28th, America's most serious nuclear power plant accident occurs at Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania. March 31st, the last British soldier belonging to the Royal Navy leaves the Maltese Islands after 179 years of presence. Malta declares its Freedom Day, which is something like Jum Il Helsayan, Helsine, something like that in Maltamanese. April 1st, this is not April Fool's Day. This stuff happened on April 1st. Iran's government becomes an Islamic Republic by a 98% vote. overthrowing the Shah. Officially, no word on what happened to the 2% that did not vote that way. Nickelodeon launches from Cube's Pinwheel experiment and begins airing on various Warner cable systems, beginning in Buffalo, New York, expanding its audience reach. My wife and I watch Nickelodeon every night. We watch Friends before we go to bed. Sorry, little confession. Also, April 1st, 1979, Dale Earnhardt Sr. wins his first career NASCAR race at the 1979 Southeastern 500 at Bristol Motor Speedway. He would go on to win 76 races and 7 championships during his career, but that was the first. May 9th, a Unabomber bomb injures Northwestern University graduate student John Harris. Boy, that saga would go on for many years, huh? May 9th, 1979. On the 21st, Dan White, not Danny White, is convicted of manslaughter rather than murder for the assassination of San Francisco Mayor George Moscone and Supervisor Harvey Milk after using what would become known as the Twinkie defense and persuading a jury that the crime was not premeditated. The maximum sentence is 7 years imprisonment with eligibility or early parole, prompting the White Knight riots in the gay community. Also on May 21st, the Montreal Canadiens defeat the New York Rangers 4-1 to win their fourth consecutive Stanley Cup. I hadn't realized that the Rangers had been in the Stanley Cup finals in 79. I thought their drought had been much longer than that. May 27th on the Indianapolis 500, Rick Mears wins the race for the first time and car owner Roger Penske for the second time. June 1st, the Seattle Supersonics win the NBA championship against the Washington Bullets. June 15th, McDonald's introduces the Happy Meal in the United States in a nationwide advertising campaign after testing the product since February in franchises in the U.S. state of Missouri. Thank you, Missouri, for taking one for the team there. July 1st, Sweden outlaws corporal punishment in the home, and the Sony Walkman goes on sale for the first time in Japan on July 1st. July 11th, NASA's first orbiting space station, Skylab, begins to fall back to Earth as its orbit decays after more than 6 years. Rumor has it it landed in Australia somewhere, I believe, or in the ocean near Australia. July 12th, the Gilbert Islands become fully independent of the United Kingdom as Kiribati. It's kind of spelled Kiribati, but they call it Kiribati, I believe. July 12th, Disco Demolition Night. A publicity stunt goes awry at Comiskey Park, forcing the Chicago White Sox to forfeit their game against the Detroit Tigers. I mentioned that, I believe, in my 1979 baseball recap. Pretty special day in baseball history. July 16th, Iraqi President Hassan al-Bakar resigns, and Vice President Saddam al-Tikriti, more commonly referred to in the Western press as Saddam Hussein, replaces him. I'm sure that was a peaceful transfer. August 4th, opening game of the American Football Bundesliga played between Frankfurter Löwen, and, or as they would say, Löwen, and Dusseldorf Panther. First ever league game of American football in Germany. So there's a Bundesliga over there, but American Football Bundesliga, I think that just translates into American Football Federal League. Bundes means federal, and Liga means league. August 10th, Michael Jackson releases his breakthrough album, Off the Wall. It sells 7 million copies in the United States alone. Big album for the gloved one, for sure. August 17th, the controversial religious satirical film, Monty Python's Life of Brian, premieres in the United States. I actually prefer that one over any other Monty Python film, to tell you the truth. So that's where I stand with that. September 1st, we're almost there, folks. Almost to the back third here. U.S. Pioneer 11 becomes the first spacecraft to visit Saturn when it passes the planet at a distance of 21,000 kilometers, which is 13,000 U.S. miles. September 7th, the first cable sports channel, the Entertainment Sports Programming Network, better known as ESPN, is launched in the United States. September 16th, there was an East German balloon escape. Two families flee from East Germany by a balloon. And again, maybe this is a coincidence or not, but at the same time, the Sugar Hill Gang released Rapper's Delight in the United States, the first rap single to top a top 40 hit, to become a top 40 hit on the Billboard Hot 100. Obviously, the East Germans needed their rap, and they would do anything to get it. October 9th, Peter Brock wins the Bathurst 1000 by a record 6 laps with a lap record on the last lap. So the only thing I have to say is that what the hell is the Bathurst 1000? Whoever, I didn't look this up, so whoever knows about this without looking it up, shoot me a comment. I'll send you some rack, all right? Because I have no idea what the hell the Bathurst 1000 could be. October 20th, the first McDonald's in Singapore opens at Liat Towers on the Orchard Road. I've been to Singapore. I haven't been to the Singaporean McDonald's. I've been to a McDonald's in Rome that serves lobster, which is pretty cool. Sorry, too much McDonald's in the show. October 26th, almost done, folks. The eradication of the smallpox virus is announced by the World Health Organization, making smallpox the first of only two human diseases that have been driven to extinction. So the other one was Rinderpest in 2011. Not sure what Rinderpest was. Didn't hear about that. And obviously that's topical in this day and age as well. The eradication of a virus. November 4th, the Iran hostage crisis begins. 500 Iranian radicals, mostly students, invade the U.S. embassy in Tehran and take 90 hostages, 53 of whom are Americans, and they demand that the United States send the former Shah of Iran back to stand trial. That did not happen, and our folks stayed there until, I believe, Election Day 1981, if I'm not mistaken. November 30th, the greatest album of all time was released, The Wall, a rock opera and concept by Pink Floyd. Rumor has it the record company fattened up their contract in order to get this thing out by Christmas, right? November 30th, Christmas season, double album, ended up selling 20 million copies, which counts as 40 million since it was a double album. So the band did all right. And of course, it was the last of the great four albums from the 1970s by Pink Floyd, the greatest band ever. Not open for discussion. Don't comment me. December 3rd, the Who concert disaster happened in Cincinnati. 11 fans are killed during a crowd crush for unreserved seats before the Who Rock concert at the Riverfront Coliseum. Been to the Riverfront Coliseum. It's kind of eerie to think about what happened there. And obviously that's topical too. Knowing what went down in Houston not too long ago at the Astroworld Festival. December 6th, the world premiere of Star Trek, the motion picture, is held at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. Possibly that should have been eradicated before smallpox, because now we can't put that genie back in the bottle. There's Trekkies everywhere. December 24th, as a Christmas present to the world, the Soviet Union covertly launches its invasion of Afghanistan. 3 days later, the PDPA General Secretary Hafizullah Amin is executed in Operation Storm 333, and Babrik Karmal replaces him, beginning the war. 10-year war, 1980 to 1990, something like that, led to the boycott of the a lot of the Western folks to the Moscow Olympics in 1980. It led to the boycott of a lot of the Iron Curtain nations to the LA Olympics in 84, and obviously probably led to a lot of the problems we have in the world still today, especially in that region. So also in 1979, thereabouts, the first Usenet experiments are conducted by Tom Truscott and Jim Ellis of Duke University. I've used Usenet, pretty cool stuff, back before we had, you know, all these graphical websites and all that stuff. So a lot of good way to communicate. I'm sure a lot of card collectors did that back in the day as well. I know we did it for fantasy football and for just football stuff in general back in the late 90s. The remains of Tsar Nicholas II and some of the rest of those crazy Romanovs are discovered and exhumed near modern day Yekaterinburg in the Russia area there by the Ural Mountains, I believe. A couple people died in in 1979, which we talk about Conrad Hilton. I'm right here. Conrad Hilton was born in 1887, obviously made famous the Hilton Hotel brand. I'm at the Conrad Hilton on the 59th floor in Las Vegas as we speak. So, and topical again. Nelson Rockefeller, the 41st Vice President of the United States, passed away on January 26th. I believe he was John Rockefeller's grandson. That would, I read the book Titan, which is the biography of John Rockefeller, and that's his, definitely his grandson, I believe. June 11th, John Wayne, an American Academy Award winning actor and film director, passed away. He was born in 1907, so relatively too soon to go there, I guess about the age of 72. June 29th, also too soon to go, was Lowell George, American singer, songwriter, multi-instrumentalist, and record producer with Little Feat. We all know him from Little Feat. And he passed away at, I believe, the age of 34-ish or so. And August 2nd, of course, we talked about Thurman Munson a couple times. 1947, passed away in 1979 on the All-Star break. Spoke about him on the 79 baseball episode, spoke about him on the players who died, active players who died in the 70s. August 9th, Walter O'Malley died, American baseball executive. Obviously, Los Angeles Dodgers were his crowning achievement, Dodger Stadium, etc. And November 30th, that famous Marxist, Zeppo Marx, American actor and comedian, passed away at the age of 78-ish. So that's some dad facts for you folks. Sorry to bore you. Thanks for listening if you're still there. We're going to talk a little bit about the 1979 Kellogg's baseball set. So these cards, and this is per Beckett verbatim here, these cards in this 60-card set were measured by approximately 1 15/16 inch by 3 1/4 inch. I don't know why 1 15/16 is the magic number, but that's pretty silly. It could have been 2 by 3 1/4. The 79 edition of Kellogg's 3D baseball cards have a 3/16 inch reduction of width from the previous year. So a nicely designed curved panel across the picture gives this set a distinctive appearance. The set contains the largest number of cards issued in a Kellogg set since the 1971 series. Three different press runs produced numerous variations in this set. The first two printings were included in cereal boxes, while the third printing was for the complete set mail-in offer. 47 cards have three variations, while 13 cards are unchanged from the second and third printings. So we'll get into that a bit on the numbers, but it's much more than the 60 cards that are advertised as being the set. The three printings may be distinguished by a placement of a registered symbol by the Tony the Tiger and team logos on the back. And the third printing, four cards, 16, 18, 22, and 24, show the P team logo, no registered symbol. And card numbers 56 and 57 omit the registered symbol by Tony. So I'll show you the back of the cards and you'll see what I'm saying here in a minute. Cards still found with the wrapper intact are valued at 25% greater than the values listed on Beckett OPG. This set was available from Kellogg's for two box tops and $2. And the offer was available until April 30th, 1980. So again, that third printing was just to satisfy these redemptions. First Kellogg's baseball set was released in 1970. And again, this is the largest, set on record for them. 60 cards, I think, up from 57. I think it's the largest set. So see what happens here. Okay. Now moving on to a couple facts about these cards. Again, 1979 baseball Kellogg, 60 in a series plus 25 other cards, maybe some more, but it's generally considered 85 card master set. Obviously no wax packs, cello packs, rack packs, wax boxes, vending cases, or wax cases. So factory set in theory, right? You get yourself a factory set for those two box tops and the $2. And I wonder how those redemptions were packaged. Like, I wonder if they wrapped these cards in the same wrapper that was in the cereal boxes. And I guess I would imagine that the cereal box wrappers were the cards were wrapped in order to avoid food issues. Like I know Dr. Jim has talked about, Topps cards had to be edible in theory. These are obviously not edible. They're plastic, vinyl, all that stuff. So you can't eat them. So maybe to get around that, they just throw them in the wrapper, right? And then put them inside the cereal. Because these came, I think these came inside the cereal, if I'm not mistaken. They weren't between the cereal and the cereal packaging in the box. These things were inside. These guys were in the crumbs, I believe. Again, three separate runs, variations, print runs, but the variations run amok on this set. League license, it says on the back, Insignia TM of Major League Baseball. And the player's license says Star, copyright 1968, MLBP, ASS, apostrophe N. I can imagine 11 or 12-year-old me thinking that was the funniest thing in the world, ASS, apostrophe N. Don't know who thought of that, but it should have been something printed differently. Inserts, these were the inserts, folks, and they were packed, like I said, in wrappers to avoid most likely the food issue regulations from the FDA. No rookie cards. The year before, it was a very popular Eddie Murray rookie card. It's not really considered a rookie card, but it is a first-year card, along with his 78 tops, as you get the 78 there. Kellogg's. It's two L's, two G's. Cards kind of have a perforation around them. I'm not quite sure what that perforation is. A couple punch points around these things. So it would have been interesting to see their sheets, whether they were, I guess maybe they were molded and then they're punched. I don't know what's going on, but it's not, it doesn't appear that they were cut standardly. There's kind of nubbins on them. And these cards, of course, like all the Kellogg's cards, tend to do the old Pringle due to vinyl shrinkage. So whenever you see these things in the real world, they look like Pringles stacked up. And it's probably a great idea to leave them that way, because I think if you vinyl stretches, right, or vinyl shrinks, so. I think if you were to try to flatten these things out, that's where you're going to end up with your cracking. I think my 74 that I bought today shows some signs of cracking there. So let's look at the front of these cards. What do you say, folks? Gorgeous cards, obviously. So just so you know, when you type in 1979 and like Joe Morgan, a picture of Billy Corgan pops up singing 1979. So just let me do that dirty work for you guys. Don't do that. All right. Don't Google 1979 Joe Morgan, or you're going to get Billy Corgan. So here's a cereal box of probably that's the Frosted Flakes there. Kellogg's obviously did Corn Flakes. They did, Sugar Smacks and blah, blah, blahs and all that stuff. I'm sure I ate all of them. So the cards, again, weren't like a lot of the food issues back in the 70s and, of course, the 60s, where they were panels on the back of the boxes. These were inside of your cereal. So I know for a fact that in my household, and I was the one that was guilty of this, I was the only collector in the family, I know my hands dug through that cereal before anybody got to eat it. And I got the Frosted Flakes under my fingernails and stuff like that just to find those cards. They're never on top, right? They were always on the bottom. So why did they do that to us? Fronts of these cards are gorgeous. All right. So I am going to go on record as saying I prefer this over the 1979 top set. Colors pop. The players look great. I don't understand how in the 70s they made better 3D cards than they did in the 80s. The sport flicks look like a bear's butt, compared to these things. Player's name is in a bar at the bottom of the card, a yellow bar with red capitalized last name only. And below that is the team. Below that is the position of the player. Okay. Other than the uniform, there's no and there's no airbrushing on this set, which we love. Other than the uniform, there's no indication on the front of what the team they're playing for is. Player facsimile autograph is prominent on these cards on a diagonal going from bottom, or I'm sorry, probably done different angles there, but most of them go from the kind of the bottom left to the top right. Beautiful facsimile autographs. Again, the position below the name. Now there's a couple oddballs in here. Our Hall of Famer there, Ted Simmons, says catcher slash outfield or catcher dash outfield. Jim Rice is left field dash DH. Paul Molitor just is infield. Pete Rose says infield. Richie Zisk is outfielder slash DH. Terry Poole just says OF for or says outfield, where there's you know, a lot of these players like Fred Lynn, for example, says center field. So Dwight Evans says right field. So Terry Poole is an outfielder. Yaz, DH, an outfielder. there is an RM Jackson that is a DH slash outfielder. So that's for Reggie. That's for Reggie, Reginald Martinez Jackson, because the I believe the last card of the set. I'm sorry, the second last card of the set is Ron Jackson from the Angels, R.D. Jackson. So R.M. Jackson and R.D. Jackson, and R.D. Jackson also is just designated as infielder, not a particular position. So those are kind of the oddball positions. White border around this card. Top arch is yellow. Red star in each of the corners on the top. Says Kellogg's. With a little trademark, 3D superstars on the top. So Kellogg's name prominent, not so much for the teams on the front other than the uniforms. And you do get a good look at the uniforms, so don't feel sorry for these guys, these owners. White stars and blue vertical bars down the sides. Pretty cool because as you move the card, the stars kind of move, right? 3D effect. Looks great. Look at that. It's amazing. 70s technology. And this was apparently the second year to feature the Kellogg's logo on front. Photo style is portrait, all posed. There are no action shots. There are no proof of life shots on this thing. Again, everything's portraitized. A couple of things I noticed is all but Bill Bonham and Bob Knepper have a glove or bat visible. So everybody's sporting a glove or a bat other than, or at least partial bat, partial glove, other than Bill Bonham and Bob Knepper. 3D, I guess, again, it's just spectacular. I think it just pops. It looks great. Colors look great on the players, and the background looks great. You know what you're looking at here. You don't need to, you know, look at it at a weird angle. You can see what you need to see. Crisp and clear portraits, 3D, love it. Let's talk a little bit about the back of these cards, if you don't mind. So the backs are very, very, very busy. Very, 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 very busy. White back with small blue type landscape layout on the back. Bottom right star is the card number. Again, it goes 1 through 60. Player's name is in full, their full given name is kind of in the top right-ish. So we're looking at George Howard Brett and Paul Leo Molitor. I always think it's really funny to when this pops up, especially a lot of Hispanic players, because their mom's name ends up being the last name. That's not really happening here. I think we don't have too many Hispanic players. But another odd thing was I bet you guys didn't know that Rick Monday's legal name was Robert Monday. That's what's on the back of his card. So it doesn't say Rick Monday. It doesn't say Richard Monday. It says Robert Monday. Bam. Now you know. Win that one on your next trivia night at the sports bar. Date of birth is there, and it's spelled out. You can kind of see that on these cards where it says May 15th, 1953. It doesn't hyphenate it or slash it with numbers. It just tells you May 15th. No hometown, no home, has their heights on there. I believe, has their weights, and their weights are spelled out too, which is kind of cool because it says, let's look at Paul Molitor's weight. It says 185 pounds. Yeah, a lot of pretty wordy, some of these folks. Team name is there. Team name is kind of in smaller font right below the player's full given name. Nothing about how they were drafted or acquired or stuff like that. It has their batting, their throwing preference, and oddly enough, has their hobbies. So George Brett likes horses and surfing. Paul Molitor is a big blur, so I apologize for that. I wasn't able to get a crisper look at Paul Molitor's hobbies, but you know what? I can do that right now, right? So what number was he? He's number 20. Let's find that out right now for everybody. Might require my glasses. So we're looking at Paul Molitor's hobbies. That's not going to work. Paul Molitor's hobby is, it's a bit of a letdown, folks. His hobby is sports. So it's a long way to go for very little payoff. My apologies. Stats. Right below the stat lines, I should say. But the stats are complete. Major league stats, year by year and career. No minor league stuff or anything like that. So it's also the source of many, many, many variations. And I'll get to that in a second here. So, below the stats is a biography, and it's not always flattering. I'm going to read you, and they kept it real, and this surprises me because this would not have gotten through approval from the Major League Players Association these days. Here's a good example of Bruce Sutter's bio. A late season sag in which he lost 7 of 8 decisions helped take the Cubs out of divisional contention and Bruce out of running for baseball's Fireman Award. And interestingly enough, it doesn't list his saves on the back of the card either for his, any of his stats, which is something that's, you know, they really pay attention to for the firemen. We're going to read a little bit about, Wayne Nordhagen, which I had brought up in the front of the cards because it was a really, really cool, really, really cool White Sox uniform, kind of the softball uniforms. So here's, again, this is how critical these folks are, right? You guys think I judge. Check this out. It took Wayne 9 seasons finally to make the majors, and his 1978 performance confirmed the 1977 view that some of his former employees may have erred when they kept him submerged in the minors. So I guess he did a good job in 1977, but telling everybody it took him 9 years to make the big leagues is truly is judgmental. That's more judgmental than I could ever be. I'm going to read myself to sleep tonight trying to find more stuff that disrespecting these players. Yes. So the bios, some of them don't have very long bios because a guy like Carl Michael Yastrzemski, my favorite baseball player, has a lot of stats on the back of his card. So he's got no bio, but he really doesn't need one. He's Yaz, right? Actually, they put a little bio on the side, right? That says what can be said about Yaz. That can be said or written about the fabulous Yaz that hasn't already been revealed. So mea culpa, they understand that there's nothing that can be said about Yaz. Sorry, guys. Again, diverging. There's no cartoon on here other than in the upper left, Tony the Tiger. There's a picture of Tony the Tiger. The bottom, the trademarks say from left to right on the bottom, Exograph, copyright 1979, Visual Panographics, Inc., insignia TM of Major League Club. So the Major League Club owns the insignias. I'm not sure if that's still the case. Probably is. And then there's a star copyright again, 1968 MLBPS'N. it says next to that series 60 dash number. And then you have the number in the star right there. So they'll tell you it's series 60 of and number blah, blah, blah. Upper right has the team's logo, the MLB logo, and the MLBPA logo. And it says officially authorized card. Now you can kind of see here, this is one of the variations. You look at George Brett's card and it'll have Tony the Tiger's got a trademark. Kansas City Royals logo has a trademark. And then of course the Major League Baseball Players Association and the Major League Baseball logo, very familiar to all of us, both have their copyright and trademarks. Paul Molitor's card, for example, that I brought up has no trademark next to the Milwaukee Brewers logo. And there's ones that have no trademark next to the Tony the Tiger. So that's some of the variations. There are a lot of other variations as well. Let's run through these things. Of course, there's no team cards, no league leaders or checklists, no all-stars, postseason, rookies, blah, 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 blah. Plenty of error cards, plenty of corrections. So there's plenty to really get, wrap your head around. And I, like I said, I think it's like 25 of these things or, 25 or so of these things or error cards. So, I'll give you an example here. Like we get to card number 5, Jim Palmer. It says his winning percentage is 649 in 5A card and 650 in the 5B card. I don't know why one percentage point mattered or essentially one one-thousandth of a percentage point, but they felt the need to correct that. Paul Splittorff, innings pitched 1665 and his corrected version is 1666. Ron Guidry, gave up 397 hits, but then the next one, his corrected version is 396. There are some wacky ones, though, some biographical ones about a trade versus a no trade for Buddy Bell. J.R. Richards' stats began in 1972 in the first version. In the second version, they began his stat lines start in 1971. Dave Parker's average is in the first version is first print run is 281 and his second print run 318. I could see him being sensitive about that because Dave Parker was a man of a hitter back then in the late 70s. So anyway, like these guys have been putting sets out for 10 years at this point. They just didn't give a rat's butt and all sorts of obvious and non-obvious errors like Pete Rose hitting 33 triples in a season instead of the more realistic 3. So, yeah, that's that. Doesn't seem to be any, haven't found any price variations for the errors. Beckett OPG lists them as not applicable. I don't know whether they don't, you know, sometimes they go back and later on and do that, but it's been 40 plus years. So I think we're not going to find out any, price differences on the variations. Let's talk about the Beckett prices, if you don't mind. Set value, $15 to $40. I bought mine in a package deal, so it didn't cost me $40, but less than that. But the value of the individual cards lists as $70.75 with an average value of 83 cents per card. Let's see here. We'll talk about a couple of the top five here. George Brett card number 50 is a $10 value. Paul Molitor, really his, obviously Topps did it as well, but 79 would have been his first solo card at Topps. So solo card on the 3D Kellogg set as well. So that's a $6 card. Pete Rose, card number 22, is at a $5 card. Tom Seaver, Carl Yastrzemski, and R.M. Jackson are each at $4. There's 16 Hall of Famers in this set. And several foyer of famers, and I count those as Dave Parker and Dwight Dewey Evans hanging out there in the foyer of fame, waiting to, they probably have their gloves and probably having a catch out there in the foyer of fame. Here's some fun numbers. We're going to do, again, I think I said earlier that cards in the original wrappers have the 25% premium above, Beckett list. The Yankees had 3 cards in the set, Red Sox 5, Orioles 2, and the Tigers, Indians, Brewers, Jays limping in at 1 each. A's had 2, White Sox 1, Angels 2, Royals 4, Twins 2, Mariners 1, and the Rangers 3. Again, remember the Red Sox were pretty darn good in 78, and the Royals were pretty good as well. Brewers, the Blue Jays and the Mariners, obviously they were token teams at that point, and 2 more teams in the American League than the National League yet. There's only 29 cards from American League players in this set. And I'll let you do the math in a 60-card set to figure out what the real deal is there. So over to National League, Cubs 2, Phillies 3, Pirates 2, Mets 2, Cardinals 2, and Expos 1 card each. NL West was kind of stacked there with the Giants at 4 cards, Dodgers 3, Padres 2, Braves 2, Astros 2, and the Big Red Machine had 6 cards in the set. Yeah, so if you follow along at home with the math and you have an abacus, that's 31 for the National League and 29 for those kids, crazy kids from the junior circuit. So that is that. That's the 79 Kellogg's baseball set. Really fun. I've been kind of looking for these for a while because, obviously brings back memories of eating cereal as a kid and collecting cards. And I don't know what could be better than that. Imagine sitting at the kitchen table with a freshly minted card coming out of a box of cereal, and you're eating the cereal and you got processed sugar under your fingernails from digging for the card. I can't think of a better way to spend a Saturday morning than that. So that is that. So I want to thank you guys for joining me this week again in my journey back in time. If you have a comment or suggestion, or perhaps you have another set you want me to go dig through and put my spin on it, reach out to me at that70scardshow@gmail.com, that70scardshow on YouTube, or 70scard on Twitter. Mango Safari, again, the playoff music on our podcasts. RIP Mango Safari. So that's about that. Enjoy your collecting, folks. More importantly, enjoy your collection and have a safe week. Thanks for listening. I appreciate it. Goodbye.